Hi, this is Dr. Kimberly Lindner, and you're listening to Incredible Life Creator Podcast. I am the host of the show and author of Visualizing Happiness in Every Area of Your Life, available on Amazon. And today, my guest is Miss Natalie Boehm. So, Miss Natalie Boehm is a strategic consultant, disability advocate, and best-selling author. She is the president and founder of the Defeating Epilepsy Foundation. She developed epilepsy at the age of 2 due to a traumatic brain injury. Despite her challenges of dealing with epilepsy, she was determined to overcome epilepsy and succeed in life. Her organization provides advocacy and educational resources for the epilepsy community and our society. Welcome to the podcast, Natalie.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
Yes, I am very, very excited to have you because I think this is a topic that there's not enough information out there about. And when, people are dealing with epilepsy and their family, they just don't know what to do or where to go, who to ask. And sometimes the neurologists don't seem to be very helpful either. And so I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing. And so just so people can get to know you, tell us about you, how this all started out as a young child and how you got to be doing what you're doing.
Well, I developed epilepsy at the age of 2 due to a traumatic brain injury. And the first 10 years of my treatment were very difficult. I was on a barbiturate known as phenobarbital, which really impaired my quality of life as a child. I did well in school, but social skills, especially feeling isolated, having emotional problems due to the side effects of meds, made things very difficult for my parents. And like you were mentioning, the lack of support from the doctors, the attitude of my neurologist then to my parents was, well, if she has a seizure, call an ambulance. There was no, okay, this is how we deal with coping skills. This is how we deal with mental wellness, where, no type of real care plan. So it was a very overwhelming experience for, and it impacted not just me, but my entire family. And then as I became a teenager, I had severe depression and suicidal tendencies and attempted suicide twice due to the medication I was on. I went from phenobarbital to valproic acid, or known also as Depakane, and it really impaired my mental well-being. So really, my teenage years were focused on staying alive, and I had no idea where my life was going to go at that point. Once I finished high school, I took a couple of years and I worked, and I realized I knew I had the potential to do so much more. I didn't want to work a minimum wage job the rest of my life. And so I went back to school with the intentions of becoming an attorney. And I did really good in my pre-law. And my last year of school, I was battling depression again. And the medication they put me on, they had to take me off of it. It caused me to have a seizure without warning when I was in my car and I crashed into a guardrail on the interstate. I lost my license for a year and a half. And at that point, it wasn't even, okay, am I going to become an attorney? It was, okay, I got to get my seizures under control, get my license back. And when I finish school, be able to get a job and be able to get my medicine, because the healthcare system over here in America, it's so dysfunctional. I mean, at that time, if I would have lost my health insurance, I would have been paying $1,000 a month out of pocket just to stay alive. I mean, that was my rent, my utilities. It would have put me, I would have been homeless. That's the best way I could put it. I would have ended up living out of my car. And just over time, as I was working, I always went back to these situations, thinking about them. And I just, after a time, thought, I can't remain silent. And I went back and I got my MBA and focused on a strategic capstone and decided I was going to create a nonprofit organization that was going to help people, where the doctors, the universities, the larger organizations, they're more focused on lobbying and pharmaceuticals. I knew people needed an organization and someone they can turn to who understood what they were going through, who could have empathy and compassion and help them find what they needed. And that's what I did when I launched the Defeating Epilepsy Foundation. That's been my goal, to provide the education that so many people are not able to get through from their doctors, be able to provide resources, even if it's not much, something to, you know, help them get a better quality of life. And I really want to target things in society, especially small businesses, to show that people with epilepsy, or people who have, a lot of times people with epilepsy also have neurodivergent conditions, that people who fall in these categories are not liabilities to employers. You know, there's many people who have multiple chronic illnesses, or they have certain conditions, and are very productive in a career. They can contribute to society. And we cannot continue with the attitude of, well, they're a liability, I don't want to hire them. And at the same time, the government's going, well, yeah, you're sick, but you're not sick enough for SSDI, so we're not helping you. There's been too many people for a long time here in America just falling through the cracks. And it's why we have the homeless problems we do. We have a lack of healthcare for people. We have real, you know, poor mental health over here. And these issues need to be brought to the table. People need to start saying something and taking the steps to acknowledge it, so we can collaborate together to start making the proper changes we need.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, you started having these seizures fairly young, and I just, I was trying to imagine how it is going to school and being at school and having a seizure happen, and how, you know, what was the reaction of your classmates? How was, you know, how were you treated? Was, you know, were you made fun of because of your seizures?
On and off I was. When I was on phenobarbital, I would get very emotional very easily. I could get scared and then cry easily, or if I had at times absent seizures due to being so heavily medicated on phenobarbital. So it didn't take much to set me off to get me to cry. And I think that was one thing. The students kind of looked at me like, why did I act like a baby? And, you know, they didn't understand. But I also think the teachers were not properly trained to deal with it either. I think they were put in a situation where, all right, they have a child in their class who needs to learn, they need to do what they can, but they're also, you know, it was a lot on their plate. And it's really one of the reasons with one of the things I do for my organization is I talk to families. I went recently to an event, a special education event in San Bernardino, and I'm showing the parents the importance of the teachers, the administrators, the staff at school understanding what seizure first aid is and how to administer it if there's an emergency. And I also put together a seizure action plan, which has the information of the individual, the medicine they take, who's their emergency contact, what should they do if a seizure does happen? Because there's so many that people, they don't even know the basics of what to do if someone has a seizure. And depending on the kind of seizure is, it can be very traumatic. Most people think of tonic-clonic seizures when people lose consciousness and stiffen and shake. But there's so many other different types of seizures. For example, I had for many years, first a tonic-clonic, but then I had complex partial when they changed one of my meds. And the complex partial, the best way I could describe it is I came off as if I was under the influence of drugs. So I would mumble, I would walk around, I couldn't do anything. I was blacked out. I did not have any idea of what I was doing. But if you would have seen me, you know, if the police would have came by, I most likely would have been arrested for failing to comply. And so many people end up in that situation because the police are not educated properly about epilepsy. EMTs are not properly educated about epilepsy. So many people who work in public jobs really don't understand what epilepsy is or a seizure is. And the result of it is the people who experience watching that person have a seizure and what they're trying to do, they get traumatized. as long as the individual who has the seizure. I mean, I've had friends who have sadly regained consciousness in a jail cell. And, you know, the attitude was, oh, well, they dropped the charges, you're okay. No, I don't think anybody would want to gain consciousness in jail and not know where they are or why they're there. I mean, one of my advisory members, his son got arrested 3 times for having a seizure in public. And the poor man finally had to go to court with his son and say, you know, my son is having these problems. Would you please stop arresting him and call for medical help in this situation? You have on file what the situation is. And this was in Scotland. So this isn't even a problem we have in America. This is a global problem.
Wow. So just so people know what we're talking about, because I know there's some people that have experienced seizures themselves. They have family members that have experienced seizures or friends, but there are some people that have not been touched at all by epilepsy. So can you describe what a seizure is? What happens? Like, you know, I know that when someone's having a seizure, they want to control their bodies and they might even know they're going into a seizure, but if they want to try and stop their hand from moving, they can't, or if they want to move their hand, or if they want to pick up something, they can, or if they're holding something, all of a sudden they drop it. And they have no control over that. And then, you know, the seizure, and then, you know, after the seizure, they're kind of like gone for a little while and yes. Then they come back. So can you just kind of describe that so people can understand?
Well, what epilepsy is, it's a neurological disorder in which the neurons are misfiring due to overactivity or hyperactivity, as they would say. And because the brain is misfiring, it causes people to react in different ways. Some people may lose consciousness, fall, stiffen and shake. There's some people who will just briefly fall. They may start twitching. They may do things like start laughing for no reason or start crying for no reason. There's many different things that can happen when someone has a seizure. And that's one of the complexities of diagnosing epilepsy or putting together treatments for people with epilepsy, because there's times when people are having seizures and they act in certain ways, especially if it's an emotional reaction, or some people when they're seizing, they may start to scream, they may start to swear. They're not thinking a seizure. A lot of people may be thinking they're acting inappropriate. You know, they're thinking some type of mental health condition, not neurological disorder. So that's why it's so important to educate people about the basics of epilepsy. But if they have a loved one or a friend or someone they know who has it, taking the time to understand what that person is dealing with so that if there is an emergency, they know how to act on it. It's so important.
Yes, yes, exactly. And okay, let's say you're at the grocery store and you realize someone next to you is having a seizure. What should you do?
Well, if they have, most people have what are called tonic-clonic seizures. So if it's a situation like that where they've lost consciousness, you would make sure to clear the area to make sure they can't get injured by anything and to roll them on their side so that if they get sick, they won't choke. And the first thing you want to do once you get them in a safe spot, you start timing the seizure. Now, if the seizure lasts 5 minutes or more, or they continue to have them, they have one, and then another one starts again, that's when it's in a medical emergency and you do want to call 911 or whatever the emergency number is in your area and get somebody there. And you want to make sure the person is not left alone. If it's something like somebody starts having a staring spell or an absent seizure, they last on average like 30 seconds to 2 minutes. I've seen kids where they'll just, all of a sudden they look like they're staring and their head might look like it's moving or twitching. All you can do in those situations is really just stand by them and make sure that they don't move in a way or any put any risk of themselves for injury. When I was working at an event for my organization, we had an event where vendors in the area came to have trick-or-treating for children with disabilities. And one of the little boys who stopped by my table, started to have a seizure at the table where he was just staring and his head was kind of doing like round rotations like that. And he just, I knew what he was doing. So I stood by him, and about 30 seconds later it stopped and he just looked at me and I went, are you doing good today? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, you want some candy? He goes, yeah. And I gave him a bag and then he ran, to go play with the other kids. But it's little things like that where if someone would have seen him, they would have been like, what in the world is that kid doing? But because I've experienced it myself, I knew, okay, he was going to be okay. I just had to make sure he didn't fall or something happened where, you know, it could put him at risk.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen where people who have seizures often, sometimes they have a helping animal.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that and how those animals help?
Yes. So for individuals who have what is called refractory epilepsy, which means their medication, they've been on multiple medications, at least 2 anticonvulsants or more, and they can't get the seizures to stop. For a lot of people who are in that situation, they may have been also had brain surgery or different devices, and no matter what they're trying to do, they can't get the seizures under control. A seizure alert dog is very helpful because what they can do is, let's say an example of an adult, let's say they're in the grocery store and they fall and have a seizure. The dog will stay with them and make sure that they're in an area where they cannot get hurt. They will protect them and try to prop them up while they're seizing. There are dogs who are trained. Let's say you have a child with epilepsy. There's dogs that they will train to bring the phone to mom and dad if they find the child having a seizure. So mom and dad know, okay, we got to call an ambulance, and the dog goes. So there's so much you can do with seizure support and, you know, seizure support dogs and other types of medical alert dogs. The frustration is a lot of times, one, they're very expensive. It could be depending on the severity of the person's health and how much training the animal will need. It can be easily $15,000 to $50,000 just to train an animal. And a lot of times, you know, people don't have the financial means for it. The insurance companies will not cover it. So families will create GoFundMes to do it, or they'll look to other organizations to help get a grant for it. But it really, I found so many people end up on either on a waiting list waiting for one, or they will adopt an animal and try to train the animal themselves and have it listed as an emotional support animal to help in some way. But it is a resource that a lot of people, I've met a lot of people who truly could benefit from it and sadly don't always have access to it.
Got it. And you mentioned other devices. Is there other things that people wear on themselves or something that helps them?
So if for some people, depending on the type of seizures they have, they do have medical devices that people can have implanted in that can help either stop seizure activity completely or cut down how many seizures someone is having. One of them is a vagus nerve stimulation. And what they do is think of it like a pacemaker in the chest, and it's connected to the vagus nerve. And if they feel like they're going to have a seizure, they wear, it looks like a watch, but it's actually a magnet. And they'll put the magnet up to it, and it'll send a little impulse. So that if a seizure is about to take place, it stops it from following through. It breaks it up.
So it's something inside their body that's implanted there.
Yeah.
Then they put the watch up to where that device is.
Yeah. And when the magnet goes up to it, it sends an impulse from the device up the vagus nerve to the brain to stop the seizure. So they have those, and then they have what's called responsive neurostimulation. It works in a similar way to the VNS, but it's actually put in the top of the brain, and they have little electrodes that come off it, and the electrodes are planted into the parts of the brain that are being effective, and it does the same thing. It'll have a battery, and the doctors will adjust it to release a pulse every so many minutes or so. And then a little more advanced one that they have is called deep brain stimulation, which is very much like RNS, but instead of it being small electrodes put pretty much into the top, these electrodes go more deep into the deeper parts of the brain.
And there's something else that has been used, and I don't know what it's called, but you probably do. It's a type of therapy where you have this hat that has all these electrodes in it, and then you watch a movie. And when you and it, you know, it first they measure like what's the overactive areas of the brain and which ones are underactive, and then they have you watch this movie. And if you're using your brain properly and I guess stimulating the ones that are in underactive and relaxing the ones that are inactive, then the movie keeps playing.
But if
you don't, the movie turns off. You haven't heard of that one?
I haven't heard that as a treatment. It sounds like more of a test. They have what's called EEG, was an electroencephalogram, and they put the wires, as you were describing, they put a special what is it? It's not like a hat, but there's so many different ones today compared to when I was little. When I was little, they just pasted the wires on your head, where some now they'll have an actual EEG cap and it'll have the same wires. But what they use for that is called the 1020 system, where they measure out different parts of the head and put the electrodes there so that they can pick up signals from different parts of the brain. And, you know, for some situations, such as what you're talking about with watching something like a movie or watching a screen, what they might be doing in that situation is seeing the emotional reaction to certain things. I've had to do tests like that, not so much a movie, but I had to put on virtual lens goggles for one thing. And they would show things like a flashing light to see if that would trigger me. Or checkerboards moving suddenly fast, different images to see if it would trigger people. Because some people, about 2% of people with epilepsy, are photosensitive. So flashing lights can cause them to have a seizure. I'm not like that. What the one thing that I have had a hard time with is what they do with the checkerboard test. It doesn't trigger a seizure for me, but I get a real intense headache from it. So the overactivity of objects moving fast causes me a lot of discomfort, such as the video games today that the kids play that are 3D and really realistic. I can't watch a screen for a long time or I start to get headaches from them.
That makes sense. And I've also heard that if people are driving and it's like, it's one of those days when the sun is just coming down, and you know how when you have a bunch of trees on the side of the road and there's light coming through and you're going fast, it's almost like that in optometry you call it OKN, but basically it's stripes of light, dark, that as you're driving, that could actually stimulate someone.
I've heard of that. That was one of the things that they did for me too with when I did the one test, was the fast moving impact to see what it causes. But yeah, there's a lot of different things they will do to see how people are, where they're having seizures. If you can't get your seizures under control, a lot of times what they'll do is they'll have you admitted to the hospital for a few days in what's called an epilepsy monitoring unit. And once they hook you up and everything, they may stop your medication. They may have you do certain stress tests, such as the flashing lights, or the one time I was there, they had me intentionally try to hyperventilate to see if it would trigger a seizure. So they'll do all sorts of different things because they want to find out what is your trigger? Is it stress? Is it flashing lights? Is it, you know, there's so many reasons people can have things that could trigger somebody to have a seizure. So really what they want to do is they're watching to see what's going on. And when they're not in the room with the patient, they have video surveillance 24/7. So they're watching you when they sleep to see, are you seizing in your sleep? Is there overactivity taking place when you're sleeping? There's many things they're looking for to try to get, you know, an answer of, you know, what's going on.
And do you know of any actual therapies like the one I was talking about, like biofeedback therapies or any things where they're trying to, I don't know, rebuild the brain or retrain the brain or anything like that?
I don't know. specifically of any neurologist that I know. I don't know if they're involved in biofeedback studies. I have taken classes on biofeedback. I really enjoy biofeedback because it really it helps break down the body. At least this is my experience when I took it, and how to really be able to connect with your body and understand, you know, how to calm yourself, how to stay in balance. And I almost use it as a form of a meditation when I'm in extreme stress. When I took it, you know, we were taught, you know, focus on one part of the body, relax it, start at another part of the body, work down, and then focus on achieving overall balance. And I'll do biofeedback practice like that after doing yoga for about 20 minutes. I'll just sit there and close my eyes and just focus on, you know, bringing my body down to a calm state.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like doing those type of biofeedback things and calming? Do you think there's ever been a time when you think you were going to go into a seizure, but you kept yourself from having the seizure? In other words, can people do that? Can they stop the seizure if they feel like it's coming on, or not really?
In my experience, when I was having real bad auras, because the best way to describe it, aura is a seizure warning, and now they consider it like a simple partial seizure. So I used to get real scared before I'd lose consciousness and have a tonic-clonic seizure. And there were times I could sit there and just breathe or have somebody next to me, like my mother or sister, just talk to me. And there were times I could calm myself down and get it to stop. And then there were times I just couldn't. It was just too powerful. But a lot of people, you know, I think it really depends on their support system. If they're in an environment where, let's say, there's a lot of toxicity in their environment, they don't really have the support they need, trying to do that is extremely difficult. Whereas if you have a loving environment and you know if something isn't right, there's someone to turn to. I think, you know, people are able to develop better coping skills and be able to do what they need to do to achieve something more like that. But it really it depends. The complexity with epilepsy is we're each different. I mean, what works for me and keeps me alive could easily kill the next person. It really is. There's no cookie cutter plan to it. That's where the challenge is.
Got it. So what if someone's let's say they're newly dealing with epilepsy, what are some of the most common triggers for a seizure?
Stress is one of the most common. Lack of sleep can be another one. There's a number of things, but I find the biggest thing has been, for a lot of people telling me, stress, a certain loud noises, think something that could scare them can cause it. When I was little, the barometric pressure dropping suddenly if a real bad thunderstorm came in the area, that could trigger my seizures. I have a few friends in the United Kingdom who their seizures during the going into the winter when the storms are coming through, it's real hard for them. And then springtime is coming, you have that shift in weather again. That's when their seizures are at the highest.
Wow. Okay. And what about diet? So I've heard of, like, people say, well, the ketogenic diet, which has been popular in recent years, but the ketogenic diet has been around for years and years and years and years in the epilepsy community. So tell me about, is there certain diets that really would help, and maybe the ketogenic or other ones, or is there certain foods that people should avoid because they definitely could bring on seizures compared to other foods?
Well, when it comes to the ketogenic diet, the keto diet, you know, has become a big fad that people have turned to that to lose, you know, massive amounts of body fat. But really, there's some different levels of keto. One thing I would encourage your viewers today, if they are interested in keto, to look up the Charlie Foundation, because what the Charlie Foundation explains is there's about five different types of keto diets. And the first three are actually keto diets, like classic keto. There's different ratios that they follow. And those are specifically prescribed by doctors for patients with epilepsy to follow. So it's not like you see people going, well, I just switched my macros to this so that I could put myself in ketosis. These are diets of classic keto. It's the meals need to be measured. Everything needs to be really strictly followed. A nutritionist or dietitian is involved in this. This is a very hardcore learning process, where something like a glycemic diet or fasting is very different. A lot of people will do fasting and keto to balance their bodies. That has nothing to do with a ketogenic diet with epilepsy. That's just a different form. The modified Atkins diet is a form of keto, but what that is focused on, it was created by Johns Hopkins Medicine, and it's focused for adults who have refractory epilepsy. And it's much more, has much more of a fluctuating, I guess you say, availability of how they can balance their meals compared to a classic ketogenic diet for a child who has epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So that there's a lot more into keto than people think. I think a lot of times when people hear a keto diet, they're just thinking, oh, some diet plan I can follow if I want to get into great shape and everything. And it's so much more than that.
Got it. And then is there certain things like, I don't know, caffeine sometimes can be a stimulant. There's certain things like caffeine or stimulants or, you know, even, you know, these artificial sweeteners they have out like sucralose that is, we all know is so bad for your brain. Is there certain ones of those that people should just totally avoid if they have epilepsy?
Caffeine can be a trigger for some people. It's not for all, along with also certain drugs and alcohol can be a trigger, but it doesn't affect everybody. But one thing I would agree with you on with artificial sweeteners like aspartame, sucralose, they really, really are not good for you. And as someone myself having epilepsy, I do everything I can to avoid artificial sweeteners because I found that I get headaches from them. And I have a friend who was having horrible migraines and had fibromyalgia. This was years ago when I was still living home in New York. And one day we went for coffee and she pulled out a few packets of the Splenda. And I was like, why are you putting that in your coffee? And I'm like, do you realize what that is? I said, that's probably triggering your fibromyalgia. That's probably why you're getting flare-ups. You shouldn't be putting stuff like that in your food or drink. And a lot of people, because they don't understand the impact that processed foods, artificial sweeteners, things that our bodies used, you know, years ago would not recognize, you know, the impact it can have on somebody when they have a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. And then in kind of the same category, sugar. The sugar that's the culprit for everything, because I know artificial sweeteners are bad, probably worse than sugar, but sugar can be the basis of cardiovascular, diabetes, you name it, sugar gets a bad rap. But what does it do to the brain? Because I know ketogenic diet is basically taking the sugar away. So if someone has a birthday party and they eat cake and ice cream and candy bar and, you know, what happens to their brain with that sugar?
Yeah. Well, I've never heard of sugar being a trigger for anybody who has seizures, but I know the importance of maintaining a healthy, balanced diet. When you're eating too much processed food, you know, when you're not putting good things into your body, obviously you're not going to have a good effect from it. So what I do is if I'm craving sugar, I try to do something like have a piece of fruit instead. I'll, you know, depending on what time of the year it is in my house, I'll have apples, or in the summertime when it's warmer, get some cut up watermelon, stuff like that. I find trying to find different substitutes is better. And it's really important for people with epilepsy to follow a good diet and eat clean, just for the fact that a lot of these medications, they do mess with your metabolism. They do mess with your hormones. That's why a lot of people who have epilepsy, even if they're eating, you know, well, not perfect, but, you know, at least following what they should be and they're exercising, there's still a good chance that they could be obese just because of the side effects of the medicine, because what these medicines do is they're slowing down the central nervous system. So it slows down your metabolism. It can affect your hormonal balance. It really has a big impact. That's why the side effects of the medicine, there's times I felt like the side effects are more frustrating than the seizures themselves. But at the same time, you have to find a combination or what you can do to, you know, keep your seizures under control, because, you know, you have to survive, you have to function in society. So it's finding multiple ways. For me, it's been keeping a good meal plan, exercising, meditating, doing things like playing music or painting. I've had to just look at my health as, you know, I can't just take my medicine and everything's, you know, all happy. You have to look at all the pieces of your health and well-being to be able to put something together to help you achieve balance. I tell so many people, and I think at least over here, you know, growing up in America as a child, the attitude was you didn't question your doctor. You did as the doctor advised you to take care of yourself. Where now I want people to see, yes, your doctor is there to help you. Yes, your doctor is there to advise you. But a really good doctor, the way you know the difference between a really good doctor and just an average doctor, a real good doctor will want you to understand how to take care of yourself. It's not, here's the medicine, I'll see you in 6 months. They want you to know what to follow, how to take care of yourself. For example, when my former neurologist, when he was at USC, we would go over how I was feeling. You know, I'd let him know about my exercise, what I was eating, what I was doing. And one day we were talking and he said, so what are you doing about birth control? And I was shocked because I've never had a neurologist ask me, what am I doing to practice safe sex to prevent unplanned pregnancy? And he saw that. I was like, well, you know, I'm past those days. You know, I'm not having any more kids. He goes, oh, no, I know that. But still, you're of childbearing age. So what are you doing to make sure of that? And of course, I let him know. But not many doctors go to that level to make sure, okay, what are you doing on a daily basis so that we don't have a situation arise? And then all of a sudden, what do we do? And that's one of the things with my foundation. I have a blogging YouTube channel, and I actually created one of the playlists I created is actually focused on sexual health and well-being, because I can't tell you how many times when I was younger, and I'd go to the support groups on, let's say, Facebook, and women going, I found out I'm pregnant, you know, what's going to happen to my baby with my medicine? What do I do? And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that should not be, you should have already known, you know, beforehand, if you weren't ready to have a baby or any risk to your medicine, what could you do to prevent that pregnancy? Or if you want to get pregnant, what do you have to do to make sure that you're ready to even conceive or anything? And I just found those resources, they just fall through the cracks. There's so many people who just honestly don't know what to do.
Yeah. And you have to pre-plan those kind of things when you're in that situation. So.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have two boys who are 9 and 11. And when I had both my sons, even before we started trying, I talked to my neurologist. I found the OBGYN I was comfortable with. For the first 3 months, I took my prenatal and I took a higher dose of folic acid. It was 4,000 micrograms a day. And I had to do that for 3 months before my doctors even gave me the green light to try. They wanted to make sure it was in my system and what should have been going on, lowering my meds as much as they could and getting my body ready before even saying, okay, we feel your body's ready now. Now it's okay to try. And I think so many people don't realize those steps on and what to do. And, you know, right now with the healthcare system and things that are going on, it's so important for women to understand these things.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned earlier about some of the medications, you know, slowing down the central nervous system, you know, and I started thinking about slow thinking. So a lot of times after someone's had a seizure, of course, they have slower thinking, but also sometimes there's lost memories, or they don't think as well as they used to, or you'll say, you know, to them, oh, remember when we did this? And they don't remember. I mean, they were there. That wasn't during a seizure, but I mean, they were there, but they're losing some of their long-term memory, or you know, it's almost like an older person where they walk into a room and forget why they're there, or they're having trouble with the thinking. Talk about that.
It's very common with people with epilepsy to experience that myself. When I would recover from seizures, I would have a horrible headache and be nauseous. And so for a couple days, just basic functioning is really all I could handle. Think, you know, get up, going to the bathroom, taking my medicine, and sadly just lying back down, because the seizures, when they happen, they suck so much energy out of you. Even if you're not conscious or aware of what they're going on, they're really impactful. And even some of the ones that you don't lose consciousness from, for example, I had real bad long haul COVID and got an infection, and didn't know I had an infection, and it almost killed me. And I was on heavy duty antibiotics for 10 days. And as I was healing from this infection, I had a couple of what are called simple partial seizures. And I was sitting at the kitchen table, and all of a sudden I couldn't, from the waist down, I couldn't feel anything. And it felt like my torso was detaching, almost like I was going to float away, like an out of body experience. And even though it only lasted 60 seconds, I won't lie, it scared the daylights out of me, because I knew I wasn't in control of my body. And just the stress of that, I felt exhausted for a couple of days. But when it comes to things like cognitive impairment, a lot of it has to do with the side effects of medication. When you've been on medication like this for years, like I have, you know, sadly, it is one of the effects. I mean, I can't tell you about birthday parties when I was a little girl. I don't remember. I don't remember a lot of special things like Christmas or certain events with family. I mean, there are things where my husband and I, before we had the boys, we used to go over to Hawaii to hike. My in-laws had a condo there. And I remember one time we were going up one of the mountain trails we really loved, and my husband stopped and was just talking about it. And he's like, remember when we were here? And he just went on, and it went, oh yeah. And I'm thinking, no, I don't have any idea. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I have no idea what he's talking about. Like, that walk didn't even exist in my mind. And it's one of the things I really encourage people who are experiencing things like this, do brain exercises to really keep your brain function going. I go on Duolingo, and I'll choose different languages at times just to challenge myself. I read all the time. I try to push myself to learn new things. And I find by just making an effort to keep my brain going and not be just sitting in front of the TV, but keeping myself engaged and going and learning, has really, really been important with when it comes to my cognitive wellness. Because a lot of people who have epilepsy, if they experience medical trauma like I have, I have medical PTSD. One of the side effects of PTSD is the shrinking of the hippocampus. The hippocampus will start to scar. And then if that puts somebody at higher risk for developing things like Alzheimer's and dementia. And that was one of the things that really pushed me in at keeping my brain activity going, doing things to relax, because, you know, it really scares me, the thought of I never want to be in a nursing home. I never want to rely on anyone to take care of me. If I'm at that stage of my life, if my quality of life is that low, I want my family to let me go. It's just, I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking, as you know, you like that time you went on the mountain and then you couldn't remember the walk. Do you ever advise people to actually journal every day, so they can look back at their memories and remind themselves? And when that happens, do they remember?
Or I find if I write things down, that's a very good tool. I do journal now on a regular basis, and I attend some support groups where we'll have a discussion and we'll journal and share what we write and everything and keep our writings to help us. But the one thing, I know it looks like a mess, but I'll have a notebook by my desk here, and anything I have to do, I make sure I write it down. And then, you know, when I get it done, I cross it off. And then also, if I have things like doctor's appointments, meetings with people, any events I have to do, I make sure it's on my calendar in the on my Google Candle on the computer, but also on my phone, because like, let's say I hadn't put this on my calendar today, I wouldn't have shown up. It sounds crazy, but if it's not on my calendar, the meeting doesn't exist. That's how my brain functions. And because I know that, I know I have to take the extra steps to make sure that I'm fulfilling what I need to do when it comes to my responsibilities and taking care of myself.
Got it. And you mentioned support groups. So is there a place where people could go and find support groups, or they just need to put their own together? Where do you find support groups?
Well, I help work one-on-one with people when they come to my organization. The biggest frustration I have found is the epilepsy community, because we've been isolated for so long, a lot of people could not get to support groups in person. And even now with technology like Zoom, I find there's a small number that are, you know, there are people who do come, they do attend, and they do talk. But depending on the severity of their seizures, do they have access to Zoom? A lot of times it's either people don't have access to the equipment they need, or a lot of times people, because they're very self-conscious about having epilepsy, they're not comfortable talking about it, even though those groups are there to help and support them. It takes time for them to feel, you know, ready to go and talk to others who are dealing with it, because epilepsy is, it's a very isolating condition. I mean, it really is. My childhood, or, you know, I have to call it, it really wasn't a childhood, but it, you know, it is what it is. I found, you know, I went to school, I went home, I read, I played music, I played Legos, I did my homework. That was my childhood. There wasn't, you know, when I had friends as I got into high school and my friends would get a car for their birthday or certain events, they were going to go away to school. I still couldn't drive at the time. There was no guidance. And that's one of the things with my organization. I'm in the beginning of working with people here in the community and creating a workforce development program, because the biggest frustration I have with the epilepsy community is they're very focused when children have epilepsy, but the moment they turn 18, all of a sudden they're gone. And it sounds so cold, but where I think the mindset comes is, you know, and I'm not saying this as an advocate, I'm saying this as a businesswoman having a business background. When it comes to marketing and strategy, nothing brings in money like a sick child, sadly, as heartbreaking as that sounds. I mean, you think of something like the St. Jude commercials. By the time you're done seeing all these poor children going through cancer treatment, I mean, you're on the phone with your checkbook, right? Ready to make a donation. If you hear, you know, about sick adults, the mindset is, well, why would I support a sick adult? You know, they're a grown adult. They got to figure this out. But these organizations are not helping these individuals who are transitioning from childhood to adulthood, who may not be able to get disability. Okay, they need vocational training, or they need to go on for a college education. They need someone to advocate for them. So things like, you know, unlawful termination or being denied a job, you know, those tools don't exist. And I want to work to start putting them in place, because you do have employment organizations to help people with disabilities get jobs. But to gain access to those things, or even something as simple as, what do you want to do? Have you started putting together a resume? Do you know what LinkedIn is? Have you done, you know, have you put together any goal setting? Do you know how to network? Do you understand, you know, how to be in an interview, how to dress, how to present, what kind of questions might be asked? So many of them don't know. And that's how people in society who have chronic illnesses a lot of times end up falling through the cracks. They're told by the government, well, you're sick, but you're not sick enough. Figure it out. But then, you know, how do you figure it out when you have a society that has put a stigma on you?
Yeah. So why don't you tell us more about your organization, what you're doing? I know you've written a book, so tell us about your book, and also where we can connect with you, website, okay. Things like that.
Well, I created the Defeating Epilepsy Foundation in 2019 and officially launched in 2020. And our mission is to provide the advocacy and educational resources needed to the epilepsy community and our society. And through our advocacy services on our site, which is www.defeatingepilepsy.org, you can find a number of community resources if you need help finding medication for career development, parents if they need to learn about what IEPs are versus a 504. All sorts of information is there. We public transportation. We do everything we can to make sure that our supporters have somewhere to go to find the basics. And then we also, for our advocacy services, we offer college scholarships. We award two scholarships every year in the amount of $500. And long-term, we want to increase those amounts. But I'm very passionate about education. And I want students with epilepsy to know that despite having this challenge, they still have the potential and capability of doing something productive with their lives. We're going to be awarding our first mini grant this year to help somebody with pain towards a seizure alert dog. And long term, we want to be able to actually help cover the cost of the seizure alert dog. So we're really trying to do things that a lot of people who normally couldn't get access to these resources can get to them. And when it comes to education, really what we're trying to do on not just a local level, but a global level, we have our blog where we write about different types of epilepsy, seizures, neurodivergent conditions, mental health, brain surgery, so many different topics that relate to epilepsy or conditions that people with epilepsy can have, which we write these using credited resources such as peer review journals, information from Johns Hopkins, Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, different medical organizations, different other journals. And we put this information together. And really what made me want to do this is, like you said, with doctors, you only get so many minutes to see your doctor. So sitting down and really explaining everything, the doctors don't have time, and I can empathize with that. But then at the same time, if they don't have the time, we have to make the resource available so people can understand what they're dealing with. So my goal is with the blog and our YouTube channels, which I take the blog articles, I turn them into PowerPoint presentations, and then do voice recording and make them into videos for our visual learners, is I really want people who have epilepsy, their caregivers, you know, pre-med students, other people who have the desire to learn about epilepsy, I want them to be able to have a general understanding of what it is, to be able to take some of the, I guess you say, ease up the medical terminology and in a very simplistic way, explain what it is and what can happen and everything. That way, because I found really, I truly didn't understand what I was living with until I started doing the research. I mean, I had in my teenage years what are called bilateral tonic-clonic seizures. So I would start with having the aura I was describing, the simple partial or focal seizure, where I would become extremely frightened, and at times it would stop, and at times it would turn into a tonic-clonic seizure, and I lose consciousness. I didn't even know that term existed until I started researching what different types of seizures there were, and so that I was starting to understand what my body was dealing with. And then when it came to medication, I created on our YouTube channel a medical series where it talks about what the medicine is and what they use it for, the history behind it, how it works on the body, side effects and risk of it, just so they have a basic understanding, educational understanding of these pills. And as I was researching things and thinking about what I'm on, I'm thinking, you know, it totally started to make sense why I felt the way I did some days, because I'm on two anticonvulsants to keep my seizures under control. And so those are, the one is a sodium channel blocker, the other one suppresses GABA activity. So I have two medications to tell my brain to slow down and relax. But then I have depression, and they put me on the generic form of Zoloft. And I got Zoloft in there telling my brain to kick it up that we got to increase my serotonin levels. So I got two pills going, chill, got to calm down. And another one working against it going, no, we can't calm down. We got to move. And I said, I sound like a biochemical hot mess. It's like, no wonder why I have the side effects I do. I'm just looking at this stuff going, oh my goodness. It's like, okay, I'm not going to be so hard on myself anymore. But so many people, because you just, you know, the doctor's like, this is what you need to take. And that's it. They just take it. And then they go, I don't know why I'm depressed. Why do I feel sick like this? I don't understand what's going on. And if there's anything I can say to anybody, I mean, not even with just epilepsy, anyone who's dealing with a chronic illness, you have to be your best advocate. You have to put yourself as number one first, and you need to educate yourself. It could be overwhelming and scaring at times, but you have to understand what's going on with your body so that you can make the right decisions and what's in the best interest of you, so you can be happy, healthy, and balanced despite any challenges you're facing from the chronic illness you're dealing with.
Beautiful. Thanks for summarizing that. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
Putting that organization together and giving that resource to people.
Thank you.
Really, really, really awesome. And I just have a personal question at this point in the podcast. Okay. What gives you the most happiness and fulfillment in your life at this point?
I would say my family, my husband, my children have really been my rock and got me through the darkest of times when there's been times I won't lie. There's times I've thought this June will be 43 years since my diagnosis. And there's times I've thought, why am I even on this crazy journey anymore? Why am I even taking the effort? And then I remind myself that, you know, society told me, you know, with the stigma, who would want to marry someone like you? How could someone like you have a family? How could someone like you be part of society? How could you even do these things? And I look, you know, I look at them and I know I can't give up. Even at times when the temptation is there, I can't give up. You know, they're my everything. And just like I've needed them for getting through very difficult times, you know, they need me too. Mm-hmm. I can't just walk away from the situation and give up and end things.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful the way you describe that. And you know that there's so many of us, not just epilepsy, but we look at whatever our weakness is in life, whatever the thing we think is wrong with us in life, and we say, well, who would want me? Who would want to be with me? Who would, you know? And it's really good point that you made, that they need you. And everyone is needed and wanted, and there's a purpose and a reason for them to be here.
No, absolutely. And I'd say that people, when you do feel like that, you know, there's such a negative stigma on mental health. If there's anything I can say is, do not be ashamed if you're dealing with anxiety, depression, PTSD, anything. I see a therapist, and at one time I would have been petrified to acknowledge that. I've been thinking, oh my God, everyone's going to think I'm crazy. There's something wrong with me. I put my head up with pride now when I say it. I do see a therapist, and I know I most likely will have to see a therapist till I die. And there's no shame in it, because it's helped me to stay better balanced and be able to do, you know, what I need to survive. So I encourage others, if you truly need help, do not be afraid to say, I need help. Do not feel shame or fear for wanting to make sure you're doing mentally well. And find things that bring you happiness. If it's, you know, exercising, going hiking, just going out for coffee with a friend, anything you know that will help increase your endorphins and bring you happiness so that you can not be focused on just the challenges or negativity, do what you need to do. You matter. That's what I tell people. You matter. So you got to look out for you.
That is so true. Well, thank you so much, Natalie, for being on the podcast today, and for all your wisdom, knowledge, being willing to be so vulnerable and share your experiences.
Yes. And can I quickly show a copy of my book? And
oh, I'd love for you to show your book.
So this is my book. It's available on Amazon now. It's called The Formula for Success. And I share in the first chapter, you know, the challenges I had in the beginning of my life and the importance of removing toxicity. But I talk about many different things in the book, such as the importance of an education, goal setting, personal versus professional goals, overcoming fear, the importance of self-health and overall wellness, being able to share your story, being able to build up your brand and be you and not to be afraid. And throughout the book, I share my stories and I share at times where I had very bad struggles and how what I discuss in the book, how I had to apply it to my life. So it's not the kind of book where someone might read a self-help book and go, well, you know, you should be doing this or this makes you do this or that. I talk about things, but then I share my own personal experiences of how I had weakness, but by learning about this and learning to apply it, I was able to set better goals. I was able to do what I needed to do. And one of the most important things I shared in the book that was really special to me was talking about my story, about sharing your story. I share in the eighth chapter my former neurologist, his name is George Noonan, and Dr. Noonan doesn't realize how much he means to me. He really doesn't. And even before I met him, I knew he was one of those one in a million doctors, because he, on his bio in his when he was at USC, it was probably one of the most compassionate, just so loving and caring to hear a doctor express his passion for his patients and everything. Would you mind if I quickly found it? Can I share it with you? I just want
great.
I want yeah. people to hear how important it is. Where is it? There we go. It's like, I know I'm not far from it, I promise. Okay, here we go. So I said in the book, one afternoon, I was looking at specialists at USC, and I came across a specialist. When I read his bio, it put me into shock. I had never heard a doctor share his story in such a way that sounded so passionate and so sincere. Here is my doctor's story. Quote, my goal is to help patients with epilepsy and other neurological disorders overcome their medical conditions and achieve their life goals. Epilepsy is a devastating disease in that it is not simply a medical illness, but affects the lives of patients and their loved ones in a wide variety of ways. While advances in medical science have made many neurologic conditions treatable, and in some cases curable, it is not sufficient to treat just the disease. One must focus on the whole person. Furthermore, medications are just one aspect of treatment, which may include lifestyle modification, dietary therapy, and medical devices. In order to properly care for the patient, I believe a physician has to get to know their patient's values, goals, and sources of social support in the form of friends, family, and community. In this way, treatments can be targeted to each person's specific needs and desires. And when I read that on the website, I won't lie, I had to read it a few times. I'm thinking, a doctor wrote this? Mm-hmm. And that's when I was like, oh, I am meeting this man. I fought like a pit bull for 6 months before the medical group finally gave in and said, yes, you can go see him. And we need more doctors like him. That's all I can say is, you know, I'm sure just hearing that you're thinking, wow. Because that's the first thing I said when I read it the first time on the website. I thought, people need to know that there are doctors who are like this. There are wonderful people in our healthcare system, despite the challenges we're all facing.
Exactly. They're treating the person, not just the illness.
Exactly.
Which is important, so important. So I have one last question before we finish.
Okay.
What is your best advice on living an incredible, amazing life?
Well, I would say one of the most important things I have found is my passion for education. To me, knowledge is power. And I found that making the effort to learn new things and experience new things really has helped me for having better overall wellness. And then I would just say, you know, do what makes you happy. Really do what you can to enjoy your life. Don't worry about, I just got to the point in life where I couldn't worry about what society thought of me anymore because of epilepsy. I just had to do what I could to do what I need to do. But, you know, investing yourself and do what you can to find happiness. Like I said, whether if it's traveling with friends and family, if it's a certain hobby that means something to you, or something as simple as one of the things that brings me a lot of happiness is going out and working in my garden. I don't look at it as yard work. I see the colors of the plants. I see the different styles. The way I design my garden, I have a lot of birds that will come to visit and butterflies, and I keep track of all the different birds that come by, and just seeing the life around me is so uplifting. So find things that are going to uplift you and shape you and make you a stronger and better human being.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Natalie.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you again.